And good morning. Good morning. This is One Land, Many Voices, the program you hear every fourth Friday here on KBOO at 9 a.m., every fourth Friday. Thanks for tuning in this morning, this very special holiday edition of One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman, and with me in the studio is Hala Gores.
Good morning, Will.
And who else is in the studio with us, and who's on the phone all the way from Jerusalem?
Well, here in the studio with us is Mary Trolin. Mary is a Palestinian-American Christian, originally from Jerusalem. And on the telephone from Jerusalem, we are lucky to have the Reverend Naeem Atiq. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning.
Reverend Ati is co-founder of Sabeel, the Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center. He is currently president. Naeem Ati earned his BA degree from Hardin Simmons University in Abilene, Texas in 1963, my year of birth, and his Master of Divinity degree in 1966 from the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, Berkeley, California. He then returned to Galilee, where he started his ministry after being ordained priest in the Episcopal Church. In the early 1980s, he returned to the United States, where he completed his doctoral studies at San Francisco Theological Seminary. Dr. Ati, it's actually evening in Jerusalem, isn't it?
Yes, it is 7 o'clock in the evening.
It's wonderful having you here with us. I'd like to start by having you talk to us about your personal history. Every Palestinian family has a tragedy to talk about, their personal story. Can you tell us about yours, please?
Well, I was born in a small town south of the Sea of Galilee. It used to be called Bisan. Today, it is called Beit Shan. And in 1948, the Zionist occupied our town with no resistance, because we did not have any Palestinian army or any militia, and so we were occupied. The town just surrendered to the Zionists, and a few days later there was a military order that was given by the Zionists that all the people of the town should evacuate it, and they gave us only a few hours, and we had to leave our homes and our business and everything. They actually divided us into two groups. They sent all the Muslims of the town to the Jordan, across the Jordan River, to the country of Jordan. And those of us who were Christians, we were sent to Nazareth, which at the time was still a Palestinian town, but you know, a few weeks later, it was occupied by the Zionists as well. So that's our story, my story, a sample story of what happened to Palestinian Muslims and Christians all over Palestine. And eventually, most of these towns and villages from where Palestinians were driven out by force, they were bulldozed, they were totally destroyed by the Zionists. In our case, of Bisan, the town was not destroyed, but Jewish immigrants came and took over our homes and our town and lived in them. So in a nutshell, this is really part of my family history. There were 10 of us, 10 children, besides my father and mother. So you can just imagine how difficult it was for my father at the age of 57 to start all over after having a very successful business in Bisan, but he had to start all over from scratch when we got to Nazareth.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a silver and gold smith. what people would call jeweler today. So he was the only jeweler in town. We had very good business. Bisan had a population at the time of 6,000 people. It was the major city in that area. And we had over 20 different villages, Palestinian villages around Bisan that came to Bisan to do business. So my father had a very successful career, and he lost everything just within a few hours.
Reverend, we probably ought to let our listeners know that my grandparents knew your parents very well.
Yes.
Can
yes,
you
I think, yeah. My father was a very good friend of your grandfather.
Abu Khalil, right?
Abu Khalil, yeah. And they used to come and visit us all the time. We used to visit them. I was Khalil is a and continues to be a very good friend of mine. We were brought up together.
You probably
I think they were all also refugees, right?
That's right. You probably don't know this, but my grandmother used to have gold coins, which she got from her parents as a wedding present. And she brought those coins to your father, and he made three crosses out of 24-karat gold for my Aunt Amira, my mother Mary, and my Aunt Nellie.
Yes.
And they still have those crosses to this day.
Yeah. That's amazing, because I keep meeting people who show me rings, earrings, bracelets, and so on that were made by my father. And it's really a wonderful feeling. Yeah.
We have with us in the studio Mary Troll, and you also know her.
I know.
Yes, I do. Yeah. I know her brother. Right?
That's right, Naim.
Yes, Rizik and, wonderful family,
Thank you. So many similarities with what you're saying about your family, the loss. The loss is what comes through very clearly to all of us Palestinians, regardless of our faith, is the loss of country, the loss of home, the loss of jobs for our parents, and the continued loss. My family had a presence in Jerusalem that we can trace for over 500 years, and there's nobody there now. And that, to me, is a greater loss than even the loss of the home, the actual home. As you know, Naim, I was born in a convent in Jerusalem, you know, whereas your parents were divided into going to Nazareth. My parents had no relatives in the Middle East. So their choice was either going to a refugee camp or else. So they found refuge at the convent up the street next to the American consulate in downtown Jerusalem.
Yes.
That's called the Mamilla area.
Yes.
So they went to the convent thinking they would be there for just 3 days. So they packed enough clothing for 3 days and, of course, ended up staying there for almost a year. And there's a really close analogy with the Anne Frank story in that when the Israeli army, the Haganah, would come looking for men and boys to incarcerate, the nuns didn't want that to happen to my father and brother Rizik. So they would close off the area, the two rooms that they had given my family. And actually, the other room was given to John Mistkawi and his family. They took refuge at the convent, too. So in order to protect Joseph Mistkawi and John and my brother Rizik and our father, they would put those big closets and block off the doors and say, no, there's nobody here. We're not hiding anyone. So that's where the analogy with Anne Frank happens.
Yes.
And I'm sure you heard the story from my brother Rizik and the trials and tribulation of eating flour that had little vermins in it and ended up earning a few pennies by ironing shirts for the Marines who were renting rooms at the convent at the time. So really interesting stories many Palestinians have to tell. Except my family was fortunate, even though it's a tragedy that they left their home. The fortunate thing is they didn't end up going in a refugee camp and become refugees. And through the intercession of those Marines and the priests and the nuns, they were able to be given Israeli citizenship and to exit the convent. When they went to the convent, it was still Palestine. 9 months later to a year later, they came to a new country called Israel, where they became a stranger in their own land. And that's our story.
Yeah. You know, you just reminded me when we were told, when my father was told, I was a boy at the time, when my father was told that we should he should leave his home and evacuate, I remember my father telling us later that he told the military governor, he said, I have nowhere to go. I have a large family. This is my home. I have built three houses. This is where I belong. And the answer came, you know, if you don't leave, we'll just have to kill you. So he had no choice. And he had also to leave and go to Nazareth. And again, we were very fortunate. Although my father could not take most of the things, but he managed to take some of the gold that he hid. My mother and my sisters hid the gold, and that helped us when we got to Nazareth. So
nice.
Instead of going to the convent,
yes,
where most of the Christian families went to, we were able to rent. My father was able to sell some of the gold and rent a house for us.
Uh-huh.
And later on to rent a shop and buy the tools and start his business again.
That's
so
nice.
I was always thankful that we were able to do that.
Now, see, my father never, ever recovered because like I said, they packed enough for 3 days. And anyway, my father and uncle had a tourist office. They were tourist guides. My uncle manned the tourist office, and my father was the guide. And the whole tourist industry was starting to die out since 2nd World War on to 1948. So when we came back, of course, the house was gone. No business there. The business was lost also. So really, it was starting from all over again with nothing. They took an old house that was left by some other Palestinian family. It was rat-infested. My mother says it took them years to get rid of the mice and rats in there. They had no furnishings. The nuns gave them a few sheets and bedding. And, of course, my father never was the same afterwards. He never had a job. He was a lost man, actually.
Yes.
And, Naeem, your father never really regained what he had. What ended up happening to him when he wanted to go visit Bisan?
Well, we could not go back to Bisan because the State of Israel obviously came into being, and we were forbidden to go anywhere outside Nazareth without a military permit.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10 years later, you know, on the celebration of the Jewish Israeli first independence, or 10 years of independence on the State of Israel, we were allowed without permits to go anywhere we wanted. So the first thing my father did was take us all back to Bisan to visit. And so we went to our three houses, and what we found out that they had, that they were divided into smaller units, and Jewish families were living there in that compound where we had our homes. And when my father knocked on one of the doors and asked to just go in and see And he told this woman, he said, you know, we used to live here. This is our home, and so on. She really adamantly and in a very unkind, unfriendly way, just shut the door in his face, and she said, this house does not belong to you. This is our home. And then we went back to our home in Nazareth, and actually shortly after that, my father was hit with a stroke, and he never recovered. You know, 2 years later, he died as a result of the paralysis and the stroke which he had. So I think it really affected him all along, because it was his life. I mean, he had to buy. He immigrated from Nablus to Bisan in the early 1920s, and went there and had to buy the land and build it by the sweat of his brow. You know, it was his life. So I think it was very difficult. But you know, when I think of my father and all that, I also have to think about the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, who many of them probably even worse than what we experienced, you know, because people were killed, people were injured, and so on. We were more fortunate because, you know, we went to Nazareth as a family. But as I mentioned, you know, in 1969, my father, 1961, when my father passed away.
Mm. Yeah. You know, you're absolutely right about the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who ended up dispersed throughout the Arab world in refugee camps. My own family, on my mother's side, you knew the family well. My grandfather had ministered to the British Army, and so he was given a heads up right during the Nakba that he needed to leave Tiberias. And in fact, the British came with a truck for him to put his furniture in. And my grandfather did not want to leave Tiberias. And he said that he would just stay there throughout the fighting. And the British soldier who was in charge said to my grandfather, Abu Khalil, if you don't leave, they will kill you.
Yeah.
And he told my grandfather that he needs to go to Nazareth because Nazareth would be safe for Christians.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me that the British knew or were in on this plan to disperse the Muslim Palestinians out into the Arab world and to allow the Christians to go to Nazareth.
Yeah, you see, the British knew that according to the partition plan, Nazareth was part of a Palestinian state. It was not supposed to be part of the Jewish state. But Israel, the Zionists, when they felt that they were so successful, they never stopped with the partition plan, and they kept sweeping through and driving the Palestinians out. And so Nazareth fell and became part of the Jewish state. And because of all the refugees that came to Nazareth, Nazareth did not retain its Christian character or of a Christian majority. Now Nazareth is probably less than 40% Christian, because most of the refugees that came from all the surrounding villages from where they were evicted, they were Muslims. And that's the same thing that happened not only to Nazareth. This is the same thing that has happened to Bethlehem. I mean, Bethlehem used to be a Christian town. Today, Bethlehem is largely a Muslim town. And again, because of the many refugees from the surrounding areas that came to Bethlehem. So it's part of the ongoing tragedy, you know, of the Palestinian people, whether Christian or Muslim.
And Naim, just for the sake of on the record, because there's so much misinformation about Muslim-Christian relations, and for the sake of our listeners, I would like to go on record as saying there has never, ever, ever been any problem between Christian Palestinians and Muslim Palestinians. We were one people. In fact, as often as not, nobody knew who was Christian, who was Muslim. We were always protected and honored by our Muslim brothers and sisters. And I really want our listeners to know that, because there's a lot of misconception saying a lot of the Christians left because of the Muslim intolerance. But in fact, Muslims are the most tolerant people that I know, much more tolerant than our own brother and sister Christians, who are intolerant of one denomination from the other. So I really want that to be very clear, that we've always lived in peace with our Muslim Christians and Muslims. And look at Christmas in the Holy Land. Our Muslim shopkeepers used to decorate their shop windows in order to honor us for Christmas. And I really have a lot of kindness towards our Muslim brothers and sisters.
Naim, can you speak to that, the misinformation that Mary's talking about in terms of what is happening to Christians in the Holy Land?
Well, I think Mary is right. And unfortunately now, you know, with growing religious extremism, you know, things are changing. But historically speaking, what Mary said is absolutely right. I mean, we did not even differentiate. We could not tell one Muslim a person who's a Muslim from a person who's a Christian. We lived in one community together. I even have fond memories as a boy in Bisan, you know, where relationships between Christians and Muslims was just normal, nothing. We're all one people. It's just different religions, but there was great respect, and we lived our life in the community. And the same thing when we moved to Nazareth, you know, it was the same thing. Unfortunately, things have changed in some places, you know, due to religious extremism. But when I look back, I think a great part of the changes that have happened have been due to the eviction of Palestinians, the movement of people, the different wars that we have experienced, and the pressures, the discrimination from the Israeli government, because the Israeli government has never really recognized the Palestinians, whether Christians or Muslims, on the same par or on the same level as the Jewish people. And recently, a report was produced here. I mean, a study was produced by Israel, by some Israeli groups, about racism within Israel itself. Israeli Jews against Israeli Arabs. The Israeli Arabs obviously are Palestinians, but Israeli citizens. And I have not really studied the report yet. I have it. I have not had time to look at it, but it was publicized, and there were people talking about it and reviewing it, you know. And it's very sad that this extremism, this religious extremism, is really increasing in our country, and to the detriment of the life of peace and tranquility that we used to have way back.
And this is Will. I have to remind our listeners that you're tuned to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO listener-sponsored radio, community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge, and of course also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website at www.kboo.org. And we're very fortunate to have as guests here in the studio Mary Trollen, but also Reverend Dr. Naeem Atik. And I'd like to mention a few of your books here because it's quite an impressive range of topics that, you've written about. Justice and Only Justice, A Palestinian Theology of Liberation. I hope we get a chance to talk a little bit about that and about the work of Sabil. Faith and the Intifada, Palestinian Christian Voices. Holy Land, Hollow Jubilee, God, Justice, and the Palestinians. And Challenging Christian Zionism, you co-authored that book, which also sounds like a very important contribution to understanding the political landscape around these issues. And then you're featured in a book called The New Faces of Christianity, Believing the Bible in the Global South. We've talked a little bit, we're hearing this morning, personal accounts of this initial Nakba, the catastrophe, that is the birth of the State of Israel, which resulted in the dispossession of some estimates as 800,000, up to 1 million Palestinians, hundreds and hundreds of Palestinian villages destroyed. Reverend Atik, I wonder if you could talk a little bit, bring us up to date. Most recently, of course, we had the Annapolis Peace, so-called Peace Summit. But the latest snag was the announcement by the Israeli government that they were approving the building of 300 new apartments in Har Homa. And I think, you know, for our listening audience, of course, a KBOO audience is better informed than most. But I think it would be so helpful if you could describe what is this Har Homa, this particular settlement, which I think is called Jabal Abu Ghneim. I'm probably mispronouncing it. But could you talk a little bit about the history of that particular settlement and the meaning of these new apartments that are being constructed?
Yes, thank you. Well, today, undoubtedly, one of the greatest impediments and obstacles to peace are the settlement, you know. And Abu Ghneim used to be a beautiful hill outside Bethlehem. I mean, you could see it from Bethlehem. You could see it from other places in Jerusalem also. It was a beautiful hill, green with many trees all around it, on top of it. Also, there were some, I think, biblical or post-biblical ruins also on the hill. Anyway, it was taken over like most of many places on the West Bank. It was taken over, and a settlement started several years ago. And they called it Har Homa. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was included in the Jerusalem plan. And in Annapolis, we thought that it was decided in the meeting presided by President Bush that Israel would terminate and would put an end to the expansion of the settlement. This is one of the problems. The Palestinians were very conscious that the land is being pulled from under their feet. And so one of the first things that were raised in the Annapolis meeting, that the settlements are an obstacle to peace. And so they need to, Israel needs to stop the expansion of the settlements, the building of the settlements, and so on. And then as soon as the Israeli leaders came from Annapolis, it was announced that Israel is going to build 300 more homes on Har Homa or Abu Ghneim, which really contradicts the agreement that was taken in Annapolis. And not only that, there were also other things that I don't think probably was reported in the United States. But they were talking about building a new settlement outside Ramallah also, which I'm not sure now whether it is still on the plan or whether it was retracted by the Israelis. But anyway, that is today, that is one of the big problems still facing us, because are we interested in peace? Is Israel really interested in peace? If they want peace, they have to stop the settlements, and they have to really abide by international law, because Israel stands in violation of so many UN resolutions, and it stands in violation of international law. And unless, and if Israel is really interested in peace, and there must be peace, we want peace, we want to live in peace, then Israel needs to abide by international law. That's it. And one of those things is that Israel must stop all the settlement activities and then look at the other issues, like the issue of Jerusalem, the issue of the refugees, which we have been talking about, the issues of borders and other points that are part of the essence and the most basic things that need to have solutions. And there are solutions to these things, but Israel needs to show the will that it is willing to pull out from the West Bank, end its occupation, allow the Palestinians to establish their own state on all the occupied territories according to international law.
You know, Naim, this is so perplexing to someone like me who really wants to believe the best that Israel says. After all, I grew up there, and I really want to believe. So here on one side they say, yes, we want to sign a peace agreement, and the very next thing they do, they go and expand the settlement. You know, I just don't understand this. I just have a hard time. I want to so much understand, but I don't. It just drives me crazy.
No, I agree. I mean, our people cannot trust these agreements or these words, you know, because Israel says stop the terrorism, and yet Israel does, it tells the Palestinians to stop the violence and the terrorism, and yet the occupation itself is really the violent action. You know, when Israel comes and takes people's land, drives them out, oppresses them, that's violent. That's the real violence. Stop. So we say to Israel, stop the violence. The Palestinians are interested in peace, but they want justice. They want their land back. They want to live in peace alongside the State of Israel. I mean, this is what the government of Palestine or the Palestinian government is saying. So they want to live in peace, but justice must be done. And justice means that Israel needs to get out of the West Bank and allow the Palestinians to have their own state.
And yet they're not getting out. They keep building more. And see, this is what drives me crazy.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
Reverend Dati, in light of Israel's conduct, despite the lip service that it gives to the peace process, in light of its conduct, do you believe that the peace process has failed and is dead?
You know, we keep hoping against hope. We hope against hope because we want to believe that peace is possible, and we believe that it can be possible. It is possible. And yet at the same time, when we see that the Israeli government is unwilling, I mean, it talks from both sides of its mouth, because it's unwilling, really, to do what peace demands. You know, peace has its price, and peace means, you know, that Israel needs to recognize the rights of the Palestinians, that these are human beings, born in the image of God. They're human, who have rights, and their rights have been violated. And in order for them to, in order for Israel to live in peace, it has to recognize Palestinian rights and it has to abide by international law. We keep repeating this. And this is the hope that we have. But I agree with you. I mean, when you talk to our people everywhere, men, women, children even, you know, everybody talks here about politics, talks about politics. And when you talk, you feel the despair. They say, look, this is all dead. Israel will never leave. Israel is not going to give up all of this. And yet, you know, you listen to them, you listen to the Israeli leaders, and they begin to talk about peace and so on, and you think, oh my goodness, these are wonderful people. They really want peace. And yet, the facts on the ground show differently. You know, they talk about peace, then they come and they start expanding the settlement. And I think, but, you know, as a person of faith, I have to continue having hope. Because my hope is in a God of justice, the God of peace, the God of reconciliation. This is what I believe. And so I cannot give up, you know.
But Reverend, why have so many churches in the U.S. allied themselves with the Israeli right?
I think there, many of these people are either ignorant or they have what I would call a very bad theology. They take the Bible, they interpret it in a way that gives greater claim to Israel, because they look at the Bible in a very literal way. They do not know that the message of the Bible is a message of justice, a God of justice. The message of the Bible is a message of peace. And many of our brothers and sisters who are Christians in the United States, some of these people in the churches, unfortunately, you know, their interpretation of the Bible is really an interpretation that does not take into consideration the true message of the Bible. They look at these texts, you know, and then they think that these texts must be fulfilled literally there. And unfortunately, we need to continue to help them understand this. That's why a few years ago, Sabil published this book, Challenging Christian Zionism, because we're really trying to help these Christians understand how to interpret the Bible. They need to understand how to live their Christian faith. They need to be promoters. They need to support justice. They need to support peace, rather than support violence and war and Armageddon. It's unbelievable. You know, I mean, it really makes us wonder why, you know, about their what we think is incorrect, unsound interpretation of the biblical text.
For our listeners, if you want to know more about Sabil, you should go to www.sabil.org. That's www.sabeel.org. Naim, can you tell us about Sabil, please?
Sabil is an organization, it's a Christian organization that works for justice, peace, and reconciliation, which means that we believe that we can live in peace in this part of the world with Jews, with Christians, with Muslims. So Sabil promotes nonviolence. We are followers of Jesus Christ, and because we are followers of Christ, we believe that we need to resist the evil, we need to resist injustice, but we need to do this in the footsteps of Christ, which means in and through nonviolent means. So we lift up a voice, even if that voice is in the wilderness. We lift up a voice for peace, but we lift this voice nonviolently, but again, very firmly, that Sabil stands for what is right and against all that is evil and that is what is wrong. And so it's an organization. We work with Christians. We work with Muslims. We have a good number of Jewish people that are working with us also, because they are progressive in their thinking. They're working for justice for the Palestinians. So we have many regional conferences in the United States. We have one coming up in February. We have one going to be in Philadelphia and so on. We have them all over. And these conferences try to help people understand more about what's happening here on the ground and our way of working for justice and peace for all the people of the land. We promote the two-state solution. This is what Sabil stands for. That is an Israel that is secure within its 1967 borders, but Israel has to do justice by leaving the West Bank and Gaza, allowing the Palestinians to have their own state, and also compensating, you know, all the wrongs, but again, abiding by international law. Whatever international law demands, Israel needs to abide by. And so, so Sabil is doing programs on the ground. We have our main office in Jerusalem. We have an office in Nazareth. We have a good number of staff that are working, trying to promote, again, within the Christian community, better relations within Christian and Muslim, again, better relations, respect, acceptance, and also working with the Jewish community, especially those who are very conscious about the importance of peace, who are working with us to end the occupation and to really see the establishment of a peaceful resolution of the conflict.
Reverend Dati, you have mentioned compensation, but what I didn't hear is the right of return. I'll tell you that one half of my family on my non, they had been in Haifa. My grandfather was working in Haifa. He had his sons with him, and his brothers had their nephews with them, teenage boys. My father's uncles and my father's cousins, the teenage boys, ended up leaving Haifa and deciding to go up to Beirut for just a few days until things calmed down. It was May of 1948. Once they made it to Beirut, of course, the borders were closed. And when I visited Lebanon in 2003 and in 2004 and saw the horrific conditions the Palestinians had been living in for decades, I think about those people. I talk to the children. I talk to the elderly who had their keys around their necks. They didn't want compensation. They wanted the right to go back home. Their children wanted that right, their children's children. Can you address that, please?
Yes. The right of return is an international law. And refugees have the right to return to their homes. Israel has never really acknowledged that right. I think it's very important for Israel, for the government of Israel, to recognize that the Palestinian refugees have the right to return. Now, once that is established, which I think is very important, and that the government of Israel needs to do it, then I think there have been many suggestions on how to really carry out that right, because there are people among the Palestinian refugees who would like to come back to their homes, although their homes have been all destroyed. But I think the international community, with the Palestinians and with the government of Israel, can find solutions. I cannot really talk into details. I mean, we've done some studies also on this. There have been many books that have been written. I personally begin by what I just said. That is, Israel needs to recognize the right of return. It needs to recognize the fact that it has a responsibility, because the refugee problem started by the intention, I mean, the Zionist intention to get rid of the Palestinians. And in fact, now, recently, one of the most important books that have been written by Ilan Pappé the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. He makes it very, very clear that the Zionist the Zionist planned the expulsion of the Palestinian people. So it is all there. It is all documented. So, and Israel needs to acknowledge its responsibility for the refugee issue. And then I would say personally that the leaders need to get together and see what is the best way to really do it. Some people need to come back. There are others from the refugees who do not want to come back because people's lives have changed. You know, there are many, many reasons, many things that have happened in the last 60 years. But I would say let us begin with the Israeli government acknowledgement of the right and it is responsibility for it. And then eventually, you know, there will have to be a resolution to the conflict in the best possible way.
And I think you're very correct in acknowledgement. You know, like you said, it shouldn't be so scary for the state of Israel because oftentimes they talk about numbers and being outnumbered. And so just acknowledging that and then finding a solution would be a good thing. And anyway, I have a problem with the state of Israel right now adding into the negotiation that it should be acknowledged as a Jewish state. To me, that has so many flavors of racism. You know, we're trying to get away from this division of Jewish, Muslim, Christian. A lot of our friends in Israel are secular Jews. They don't want Israel to be a Jewish state. They've always vocalized about not wanting that. So all of a sudden, the government is kowtowing to the religious right and saying it has to be a Jewish state. And I don't know. I don't like that direction that they're going. So instead of mellowing and being inclusionist, they're becoming more separatists, I guess.
Yes. No, I agree. I mean, whether Israel, the government of Israel likes it or not, eventually it has to face the threat of demography. I mean, that's what they talk about, that the Palestinian numbers is growing. The Palestinian, when you look at the rate of birth, and again, many papers have been written about this. And as you said, many Jewish people, a good number of secular Jews talk about a secular state rather than a state for all of its citizens, not a Jewish state. And the Palestinian Israeli citizens are demanding equal rights. If Israel talks about being a democracy, how can Israel be a democracy and deny that democracy for over 1.2 million because they are not Jewish?
Yes. That's always been our contention as Palestinians living within Israel as Israeli citizens, is that, yes, of course, Israel is a democracy, but it really isn't a democracy in that it's exclusionary. So unless you're really Jewish, you really don't live in a democratic state because you don't have the same rights. My cousins up north in the Galilee can't build a home wherever they want to because they happen to not be of the same persuasion as the majority who live there. So they have to go through the court system, and then as often as not, the courts rule against them to live wherever they want to live. So there is segregation, there's second-class or third-class citizenship, and I don't think that is a democracy when that happens.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, many people today within Israel, both Jews and Arab Palestinian citizens, they're pushing and they're lifting up a very strong voice talking about that Israel needs to be the state for all of its citizens, equal democracy for all people. And I think ultimately it has to happen, you know, because soon the Arab Israeli citizens will be about 25%. And I think their numbers are growing rapidly.
Reverend Atik, we have, a U.S. audience here in Portland, Oregon, and you've traveled throughout the United States. You've talked with people here. I think you have developed an understanding of the United States' role in this conflict. One of the reasons that I think the Israeli government, the most right-wing elements of Israeli society, feel so emboldened and so strident in simply pushing forward with this ongoing campaign of dispossession, of taking over more and more Palestinian land, is because they feel confident in the support of the United States. I wonder if you could talk about the role of the U.S. government's policy in this conflict and how people here could be working to change that policy to actually contribute in a concrete way to bringing about a just resolution to this conflict.
Yes, thank you. I think one of the problems that is facing now, the United States, has been facing the United States for quite some time, is the presence of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States, AIPAC. These are, and they have their links with the neoconservatives in the United States, and they have become so strong in the Congress, or influencing the Congress, that actually they have, we can see it, that they've been successful in making, in the fact that the United States, American foreign policy in the Middle East is really set and is guided by these people. And it's very dangerous. That's why, unfortunately, the United States government has not been an honest broker. We all, many people here, love the United States. We see that that's where our friends are. That's where it is the most generous country in the world that supports people. And yet, unfortunately, it has not been an honest broker in this very thing, because of its almost blind support of Israel, of the government of Israel. And this is very tragic, because the United States can play a very important role for peacemaking and for reconciliation here. But because it has been definitely only sending money, billions of dollars every year, for the government of Israel, it has not really been able to really serve as an honest broker in forcing Israel or impressing upon Israel to abide or to fulfill, to implement United Nations resolution and international law. If the United States can do this, Israel will be secure. I mean, we are not talking about destroying Israel. We want Israel to live securely and in peace. But Israel is doing injustice, and Israel is violating international law. United States can help in this. It is the only country, actually, that Israel trusts, and the United States is the only country that can make changes, can make a difference in the situation here by impressing upon the Israeli government to implement UN resolutions and international law. So this is really at the heart of any solution. And the United States, we all recognize, the Palestinian Authority recognizes, that without the United States, nothing is going to happen in the world. You know, nothing is going to happen in terms of peacemaking here in the Middle East. And yet, we wish, we pray, we work for an honest broker role for the United States to really have in this. And unfortunately, the presence of AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby, is an impediment to this. And
Reverend Dati, we're coming close to the end of our show, but I wanted to bring you back to Christians in the Holy Land. Before I do that, as you were talking about what you wished for, I have a wonderful Jewish friend who's my jeweler here in town, and he would say, from your mouth to God's ears. I want to bring you back to what challenges Palestinian Christians currently face in the Holy Land.
Well, you know, when we talk about Palestinian Christians, you cannot actually, in many ways, separate them from the general, because they, most of the Christians here are Palestinian. So you cannot really differentiate them from the rest of the Palestinian community. So I think our hopes are for peace based on justice. The challenges that we really face are the same challenges that our brothers and sisters who are not Christians face. That is closures, a very bad economic situation, no jobs, because chopping the Palestinian areas to over 500 checkpoints that separate people from each other. The building of the wall, which has taken so much of Palestinian land and separates families from each other, businesses, children from going to school. All of this the Israeli government has approved and has done. And these are the challenges that really prevent people from even living a normal everyday life. In addition, obviously, for the bigger issues, which is the ending of the occupation, the ending of the occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state.
And on that note, we have come to the end of our hour. Reverend Dati, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Mary Trolin, thank you for coming up from Salem.
You're welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
And if you know some friends who would like to listen to this program, they can tune in online. All of our past programs, including this one a little bit later today, will be available at www.pdxjustice.org, where you'll find links to other programs about this and other very important topics. You've been listening to One Land, Many Voices. You're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio, community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. And, of course, at KBOO.org online. Thank you for listening this morning. Happy holidays, happy solstice, and happy new year. Thank you.